Kia ora koutou katoa. John here, A Sound of Life, Episode 4. Well, who would have thought, I'll rephrase that, I never thought that this experiment would get to Episode 4. So thanks for those who have encouraged me along by downloading. Not sure how much you've actually listened to, but enough for me to carry on and a good way for me to decompress personally. So it's a bit of therapy, I suppose. Every couple of weeks about what's been going on. So really excited to wrap up the year. I don't know when you'll listen to this. I don't know if you'll listen to this, but it's the 20th of December, Tuesday. So it's kind of the reflective week before Christmas. And got a really exciting episode to finish off the year. Started my guest line with Natalie Ferguson, and we had a fantastic conversation that went kind of al fresco and ended up in a place. Women in leadership. I think it actually fits both categories, women in leadership and women and leadership. And I'm pleased to say I had an amazing conversation with my next guest around the same sort of topics, as well as exploring just a little bit of her genealogy and history in terms of getting to the amazing heights of an executive career that she has. So Raylene Castle, a dear friend of mine, we worked it out of over 24 years, 25 years, I should say, and a great conversation, bloody slowed down or reduced by some technical issues I had. Very, very annoying. So we started about half an hour late, all due to me. I try to blame it on fictional characters that do not exist in my technical team. I do not have a technical team. So this is the intro. It's going to be 15 minutes on the dot. I've got my little hourglass. What do I want to say in this? Well, firstly, I want to say what an amazing interview I think it was with Raylene, just in terms of her openness. And there's an Easter egg. There's a piece at the end where I think there's the potential to start a new movement or a new way of thinking about what's commonly known in the world as imposter syndrome. And yeah, we have a pretty interesting but short chat about that. So I'm really hoping that that Raylene will join me again at some stage in 2023 to expand on that. And look, why have I gone down this path? I thought about that the other day. You know, I'm experimenting. I'm trying to validate the usefulness of this. So feel free to give me perspective on that, good or bad. But you know, this whole area around gender diversity. Big fan of super diversity in all fronts, but gender diversity, when it comes to being a serial founder, is, I think, one of the key issues about how to design something that endures and engages. And I guess, you know, when you're building something, to me, that's two words that it comes down to pretty succinctly about what makes a successful business. It's one that endures all the ups and downs of establishing. And it's one that engages authentically. So what that means is that people resonate with the solution that you provide and they keep coming back to it. And ideally, they also tell their friends and their associates and other companies and you know, they become your biggest fans. So endurance and engagement, really two one key things. And I think that sums up quite a lot of the differences between men and women, to be honest. In a lot of cases, but more importantly, as I've said previously and with Natalie and again on this podcast with Raylene, is this whole consumer decision-making tree generally ends up with a senior influence being a female voice. So why on earth don't we have more female voices at the top tables making these decisions and inputting how that decision tree works, how people think about that? And it just makes no sense to me, and I frankly think that we are using some convenient excuses about this imbalance to basically just delay the transition. And I don't think that exclusively sits with men either. I think we've had some fascinating and somewhat frightening conversations about women who have got to the top and you know, some views that they don't actually put the ladder down around that gender side of things. They do the opposite. So topic for another time. But really hope you'll either fast forward this right now to the conversation with Raylene, or you'll stick with it and in about 10 minutes listen to Raylene and I riffing around various aspects, but mainly around women in leadership, executive behavior, and a little bit about her career, which has been an amazing one so far and just seems to be on a path to keep climbing higher and higher in altitude in terms of success. So I've got some ramblings. I didn't actually put my conscious versus considerate blog link in the Substack last time. I did talk about it, I think. That's just really a little bit of a riff that I do. I did it semi-permanent and then turned it into a blog post about how we believe, or I believe, and Andrea, my co-founder at All Things Considered, has aligned around this, that really, you know, conscious consumers are useful, but not the end game. You really need to start becoming considerate. And the difference primarily being intention and direction, and, you know, continued direction to be considerate. You can consciously consume stuff that you know is bad for the planet, and that you know is not as ethical and sustainable as it could be. So consciousness is really only one step in the progression that I think needs to happen. So the link for that is there. Got a Harvard Business Review article, and certainly in my portfolio, I've been talking a lot as we end the year, as people start to look forward to a bit of a break and a bit of a reset. Burnout, I think it exists everywhere. I personally am knackered. Just been a big year, some projects that have taken a lot of time unexpectedly. So I've had quite an imbalanced portfolio this year in terms of where I wanted to spend most of my time, which is this new venture. And a little bit of derailment there, which was fine. That's what you get when you sign up to commit to supporting organizations in whatever role. But really looking forward to getting that back into focus in 2023. After a decent rest, and this Harvard Business Review article was actually written in February 2021, and I pulled it out for a number of conversations I've been having about how to support executives, CEOs, and in fact, directors of boards are tired too. You know, it's been a hell of a couple of years in terms of making big decisions quickly that have massive potential impacts, both positive and negative. So a little article there on McKinsey, from McKinsey, about that burnout, you know, how people are handling it. And the bottom line for me is I think that Christmas / you know, festive holiday season is not going to be enough for the level of fatigue and impairment that we have out there in the executive community. We're going to need more active programs to monitor, identify, and manage the effects of people really, really working to extraordinary levels of imbalance in terms of, you know, just basically being burnt out. Hope you enjoy having a quick read of that. Next one is around Gen Z being super savvy around greenwashing. Again, McKinsey. I don't work for McKinsey. McKinsey doesn't sponsor this podcast, although there is a slot available, McKinsey, if you would like it. Says basically 88% of Gen Zs don't believe the eco claims presented on brand websites. Well, of course, you know, it's no surprise to me. But I thought it was an interesting one for folks out there, just as a bit of a reinforcer about where your consumer community, if you're doing something B2C or, you know, in that consumer area, is going. Gen Zs, you know, we all have our little stories about frustrations intergenerationally, but the bottom line is that I believe they will be somewhere between 30 and 40% of the consumer dollars in the world in terms of that generation within 5 years, possibly more. So it's a force to be listened to if you're building a business that needs that consumer momentum, consumer support. And yeah, I mean, I think the nice thing about it is it picks up is that, you know, the Gen Zs are actually more prone to actually take action around these misbeliefs rather than just sort of roll their eyes. They'll actually change their consumer behavior or they'll actively do something to express their distrust, disappointment, and frustration, which is cool. Got another article from NFX, Network Effects, which is a really cool Silicon Valley-based venture capital organization, basically founded by some very savvy operators, James Currier and Pete Flint. Pete did a business called Trulia, which I highly respect because we took a lot of inspiration for that for homestock.co.nz, which I co-founded and sold, was sold to Trade Me last year. And it's around uncomfortable tech. These essays that James and Pete put together are really quite valuable. They're big into marketplaces. they're big into network effects in terms of what they invest in and what they believe in, and also what they see as the core ingredients for anything to be successful. So good read on anything if you're a founder looking to understand sort of some of the thinking related to successful companies, particularly around network effects. Their first essay on network effects is absolutely brilliant. They identify historically from a research orientation about 13 different network effects that have played out in successful organizations, literally right back, 40, 50 years at least, possibly longer, and how to sort of identify and encapsulate those into your strategy and your business. So yeah, it's around the discomfort of uncomfortable tech in this essay, and that's really about tech that really actually there's actually a phase in the stack they designed for uncomfortable tech adoption called fear and grief, and that's something I think we've increasingly seen. I'm going to throw something out there that I haven't written up, but it's holiday season, and if you are listening to this and you've got a few moments, you need to try ChatGPT. So it's ChatGPT, as in Chitter Chat, ChatGPT. If you Google that, I think the URL is openai.com or something like that. But this is this, radically deep AI engine, which, I've trialed it on a few things in terms of just saying, make me a summary of this text, and pasted some text in. And it's uncanny, it's fast, and it's value add. It delivers grammatically bang on summaries, and just sort of, for me, cuts out a lot of that sort of last moment stuff in terms of, oh gosh, there's got to be a summary of this as well as the full document. I'm not very good at doing that. How do I do it? So I think it's going to have a massive place in the world, but it's also pretty scary. So I'd put a lot of that AI stuff, the reason I thought about it, doing the summary, is because it, for a lot of people, I think it's uncomfortable tech. Because if you look at the way it summarizes and spits out information, there's a lot of people in that role today. But on the flip side, I think it's going to enhance creativity, because there's less time spending on that sort of more tactical stuff and more sort of thinking about the inputs and the creativity. So ChatGPT, check it out if you've got a spare moment. Finally, couldn't leave this episode without looking at the irony of the world we're in at the moment around most things, actually. One, from how fast things are moving and changing. And this is an article from Emerging Brew. It's a daily that I subscribe to and really enjoy. A very savvy team there in New York. Well, probably across the world now. And this one's just... just summarizing the mass layoffs that we've had in tech, driven predominantly by Silicon Valley originated companies. I think the layoffs extend into their workforce right across the world. But the point I wanted to make is, holy shit, who would have thought only 12 months ago we were all rolling our eyes if we were in tech, at the massive shortage of tech workers and the escalating demands they had for remuneration. And now I think we've got over 100,000 folks out there looking for a job. So the world seems to be one of compression at the moment in terms of sort of going quickly through these cycles and having sort of multiple layers. We've got geopolitical risk. We've got technological change at pace, and we've got the sort of traditional economic risks. A lot of them generated by the pandemic, but I think also some of them cyclic, and they just seem to be hitting us in waves, especially in New Zealand too. We've had some horrific human events as well, the earthquakes, the massacre in Christchurch, terrorist attack. I don't remember a time, not that I've researched it deeply, where we've had so many layers of these different sorts of things to challenge us in such short timeframes, and obviously a number of them unsolved at the moment. And what that means is, particularly around Ukraine, Europe, instability is we just still don't fully understand the impacts of such an event with such a massive bow wave around the things that we consume. And you know, probably most importantly in that category side of things, food. So my summary, the world is a crazy roller coaster of a place right now. But don't let that perturb you from having a wonderful break. There's a lot to be grateful for, especially here in Aotearoa. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday season for yourself and your family, and you recharge and reflect and rethink about your purpose and what you're going to do in 2023 for yourself and for others, and for your own satisfaction at the end of this journey called life that you can look back on and be proud of. That's my goal, as well as having some very long naps, switching from vegetarian to invoking my flexitarian card and moving into enjoying the traditional fare of Christmas, and then recalibrating, refocusing, and giving it my all with my new venture, All Things Considered, and supporting the rest of my portfolio in, you know, director and advisor roles into 2023. I think it can be a good one, but man, yeah, we've really got some challenges to think about collectively, and also strategize as different organizations and the roles we play there to get through and optimize in some really interesting times. So have a good one. Here comes Raylene Castle and myself. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great 2023. Over and out. Kia ora. Two, one, two. Ah, brilliant. So happy. One, two.
Hello.
One, two, three.
One, two, three. One, two, three, four.
Oh, gosh. It's like an epiphany. It's like, it's like I was mute, but now I have speech.
What was it? Was it just needed a whole reset?
Oh, look, I talked to Terry in audio, and she spoke to Bobby, and between them, I think they sorted out some sort of technical network issue.
Brilliant.
Welcome, everybody. This is Sound of Life, episode 4, and it is in run and gun style. And I'm not sure whether I've explained that to my guests, but basically what it means is I'm too lazy to edit it, so whatever we say from this time forward, we actually just record and run with. So it is my...
Good to know.
Yeah. No, so there's no opportunity, because it's just too hard for me to remove anything. So you do have to, I guess, be quite considerate about your responses. You saw that in the contract you signed, didn't you?
Yeah, that'll be the one. Big payment contract that I got for helping you out with this conversation.
Yeah, there's been an issue with the payment, but I'll cover that with you after the podcast, if that's okay. Raylene Castle, welcome. Kia ora. I'm very excited about this conversation because this will personify carefully a lot of conversations that we've had socially, which have been very enjoyable and a bit of an event, to be honest, I think, certainly from my point of view, around our worlds and how they come together. And, I've just been very appreciative of your friendship over, gosh, I was trying to work it out the other day. It's a long time, isn't it? I'm not sure whether we should share that with guests, but
well, it's north of 25 years, John. I know that much.
25 years, yeah, that's scary. Scary.
We were so both young and had no wrinkles.
Yes, well, yes, that's true. If I could remember back that far, I'm pretty sure I might have had some. But yeah, 25 years. So look, your career, and I've got two listeners now in the US. And so I was conscious that I do need to do an introduction for my guests because they are quite a way away from us in terms of just my assumption that everybody knows who my guests are and how they sort of fit into the world. So I went on Wikipedia, which is great. So just a quick intro to you, which feel free to correct in any shape or form, but you were born in Wagga Wagga.
Or Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga, I'm sorry, I should have asked about that before. But a very quick migration to New Zealand, early in life, less than a year old. And, yeah, I mean, the Wikipedia doesn't do you justice, really, in terms of your career when I met you. Xerox, Bank of New Zealand, Telecom as it was back then, And yeah, a slew of executive appointments, I think mostly in marketing. And then for me, an incredibly impressive achievement in 2013, CEO of the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs. And not just CEO, but the first female CEO ever in the National Rugby League in Australia. So I'm really keen to dive into that experience. And then followed on by another really interesting challenge, 2017, Rugby Australia. And in between that and your current role, you were awarded the Officer New Zealand of Merit for Services to Sport and Business, which is just absolutely awesome. And now we're talking to you live, run and gun style, as the CEO of Sport New Zealand. And so, man, it's, I have to disclose that out of all my friends, you are probably my go-to when it comes to sport. because
well, I'm pleased that's what you said. I wasn't quite sure what you were going to say, but it's a safe place, so that's good.
I mean, I've never seen anybody as passionate as you are about sport, and I'm really keen to sort of dig in for some context for our listeners about sort of how that came about and how you see that in the world. But obviously, you've been recognised for your achievements and actually helping bring sports together for people as an administrator, as an executive. And I think you've got a really interesting perspective on something that we kicked off in the last episode with Natalie Ferguson, almost accidentally, actually. And I will ask you this question as well. I did have a script. I was quite organised, but I asked Nat what books she was reading. I don't even know why I asked, actually. It wasn't on my script, but she said she was reading some trashy novels and a number of books on women in leadership. And so we basically just ended up for the rest of the podcast riffing around that second topic. The trashy novel stuff was of no interest to anybody, I don't think. But yeah, so what have you been reading?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm not, if I'm really honest, a great reader of sort of business books or leadership books or any of those. I do read a lot of fiction because it is my way of decompressing, and I find that if I have a couple of hours to sit down and read, it's a really good way of me sort of relaxing, and the use of your imagination in a constructive way or in a relaxing way is always worked really well for me. You know, just have some downtime. So why don't I read books? I'm fortunate to meet and mix with some really interesting people every single day. And so for me, it's always been on-the-job learning. It's been about who I see, who I observe, who I'm fortunate enough to meet with, and watch how they deal with certain situations. And so I'm sort of a kinesthetic learner, really, and that's always been more for me than reading and highlighting books. So, yeah, that's just kind of always the way I've done it.
So one of the ways you could actually position that from a PR and marketing point of view is that you were a very early adopter of Web3. you've been in that three-dimensional kind of virtual world of just actually engaging with real people for years.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it's a really curious mind. I've always been interested in how people have done things, why they've done it, what made them make certain decisions. I've been fortunate to spend some time with some very, very high-profile leaders. I was lucky to, during America's Cup time, travel around the country with Sir Peter Blake for six weeks, and we visited every town and city promoting the America's Cup, and that gave us a lot of downtime driving between cities and, you know, catching up at dinner and, you know, asking him how did he bring a crew together that sailed around the rest of the world. You know, how did he choose those people? What was important to him when he was bringing together that leadership group? You know, all of those things. And so, you know, that's been a really important part of my learning is being fortunate to, you know, be in part of mix with those people and take the little, you know, spots of gold out of those different people that I've been fortunate to, you know, mix and meet with and then, you know, start to join those together and take those learnings. So, yeah, absolutely. I've had some amazing opportunities, and I haven't just let them wash by. I've made the most of them.
Wow. So Peter Blake, I mean, never met him. That's obviously an experience that you just can't recreate now. Amazing. So let's start with sport, and then I'm going to build into to business, and then I'm going to tackle leadership and culture just as a bit of a stack. We'll notice in advance. Very clearly, not only, you know, not just in the sport domain, but certainly in your recent career. Guide me through kind of the journey for Raylan Castle, having this, you know, sport focus and sport passion.
So both my parents represented New Zealand. Dad, before we were born, my brother and I, Ryan, and then he captained the Kiwis in the 60s and, you know, grew up when he was still involved in rugby league coaching and selecting and things. And then mum took up bowls, lawn bowls, and ended up going to 4 Commonwealth Games. So sport in our house wasn't something we did. It was our religion, really.
Yeah.
And I don't think it, until I've, you know, got older and reflected, the real upside and benefit and why I'm such a believer in the value of sport is that it does encapsulate many learnings and opportunities that you have in a business environment, that you have as a young person navigating what the world looks like as you go into it, you know, leave school, go to university, leave university, try and get a job. And, you know, so the social connections, that you have to make, the decision-making that you have to make inside a game, you know, leadership opportunities that you get given, dealing with success and disappointment because you get selected and then you get dropped, or you, you know, make the team that you want but don't get made the captain. And, you know, so all of those are really good analogies and alignments and learnings that you have, which you don't realise that you're having, until you find yourself in a situation, you know, that first job situation, and how do you, you know, deal with that? And suddenly you've got some skills and capabilities that you didn't realise you had, but you've learnt them through your sporting engagements. And so I think it's at a personal level it's important. At a national level it's important because, you know, it can bring New Zealanders together, and we saw that most recently with the, you know, Black Ferns winning the Rugby World Cup was just extraordinary. And I was just sharing this morning a story where not only was the performance and the winning extraordinary, but my colleague was sitting in the stands. She'd bought her ticket, and on one side of her was a 3-generation deaf family who stood up and signed the national anthem when it was sung. Wow. On the other side of her was an Indian dad and his wife, who had brought his wife and 4 daughters along because he wanted to show his young daughters how girls could do anything, and here was an opportunity to see it for real. And then the national anthem was sung in Te Reo, and in the sweetest, most in-tune, loud version I've ever heard it sung, John, ever in all my sporting opportunities over the years. And that was because it was a different crowd. It was a younger crowd. It was, you know, more whānau based. So it was just amazing. And, you know, I believe that sport can change lives. I'm not saying that, you know, musician or drama or musical drama or acting or any of those other things can't, because they all do. But in, you know, New Zealand context, sport, you know, holds that end-to-end element. And we all know that physical activity is good for us. And the more fit we are and healthy we are, the better we can perform, whether that's in a work environment or a whānau environment. So, you know, across the spectrum, it makes a difference in New Zealand, and that's why, you know, I really believe in it.
I mean, as you know, I'm a bit of a I'm a bit of a laggard when it comes to sport now, embarrassingly so, of any type, of any gender. So I have to say I didn't follow it as closely in the beginnings, but certainly cognizant, you know, and those stories you just told are very poignant, I think, as well, about what this this win at the Women's Rugby World Cup has done. I mean, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how pivotal do you think this whole, you know, stack of what's been built around the win actually is for us as a country?
Well, I think it's momentous, and if you think about the sort of Hollywood script that was started way back 12 months ago, almost today, when Black Ferns came home after getting absolutely, you know, towed up, to be honest, by France and England, and the systems and processes that got put around those women. There was a review, there was a you know, an honest feedback where the culture wasn't as good as it could have been. And so they looked that in the face and worked out what they need to do with it. They appointed arguably one of the world's best coaches in Wayne Smith, who had the mana to step into that environment and really make a difference. And I was lucky enough to hear that he'd said something really interesting, which was that women have to feel good to play well and men have to play well to feel good.
Right.
And I just think that's a really interesting analogy about dealing with the differences. It goes to diversity in conversations, why it's valuable around a board table, but why, you know, you have to have, you know, different voice and why you have to think differently. You know, in a sporting context, women aren't just little men. They're actually, you know, have their own skills and capabilities in their own right. And then, you know, not only that, but they actually, you know, got through that that game, and then they you saw it bring New Zealand together, and then you saw the total authenticity of how female athletes represent themselves and how you know, genuine they are and how they can take on a journey. So in a context of sport, you've got a review, you've got actions, you've got outcomes, you've got implementation, you've got success, and then you've got celebrating that success in a way that was meaningful for the whole of New Zealand. So you pick that story up in a business context and you go, right, how do I implement that into something that's working inside my, you know, business environment? So important for women's sport. You know, I'm a great believer in you have to build the base really strongly, and that's about coaching, strength and conditioning, building the product so that the product speaks for itself, and that's when the commercial dollars follow. And that's what the Black Ferns showed us. The commercial dollars will follow more significantly now for them because they proved and showed to us a product that all sports fans, be they men or women, want to sit down and watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly aspirational, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was, I think it was the way they play the game as well. It's, you know, strength is not always a good thing, and you know, love men's rugby, but it gets very caught up in the scrum and the ruck, and where the ball was doing the work in the women's game. So they were adventurous, they were throwing the ball around. The scrums and ruck are just a mechanism to rotate the ball and get it back into play again. So, you know, it's a sort of a different approach, but that's what made it, you know, I heard lots of people, lots of middle, you know, older middle-aged men say it's like what rugby used to be.
Right.
Rugby used to be before it went professional, when you didn't have 120 kilo guys, you know, playing on the wing. And so that's a, you know, that's a, you know, that's just a point in time that's different, and the women's game will change as it becomes more deeply and widely professional. But we don't want to lose those nuggets, because that's what turned the crowd on and made it really interesting to watch.
Yeah, and I love the way that you go back 12 months, and, you know, this is not a story that sort of, yeah, it there must have been, and we'll come back to this, there must have been some pretty courageous conversations, some you know, some facing into, well, as you say, and for my two American guests, you know, a toweling is it's a pretty severe continuous defeat of a team. I don't know the American analogy of who got a toweling in the NFL or the NBA or any of those, but if we can kind of take that into the business context, so get the sport piece now the business side, and we've already covered some of that, as you say, in terms of how that that story is going to lead to, you know, lots of a really interesting commercial side. But give us your view on business and Raylan Castle's sort of career progression, and, you know, where you wanted to end up. And I think for me, my observation personally would be that you've been quite intentional about your career path, which I really admire. But I'm keen to see whether you have the same view.
I probably only ever had one intention, really, and that is when at some stage they bury me, or actually, you know, have a funeral, that someone is kind enough to stand up and say she made the most of every opportunity. And that's probably as I have a competitive underbelly, so that's helpful, because you want to get to the next level and the next opportunity and create the next engagement. But had always wanted to work in sport, but didn't quite see the opportunity to start in that when I finished my Bachelor of Commerce. And the corporate world, the reality of sport now is that it is a big and increasingly a very big business. And so you do have to have some good base skills in, you know, the business context and experience, and that's what big corporates in this country give you. They give you opportunity, they give you training, they invest in your professional and personal development, they teach you how to write a really good business case, they teach you to deal across departments and you know, navigate your way through complex you know, hierarchy and political environments. And, you know, when you overlay that into a sport environment, none of those things are very different. They just happen tend to happen on a smaller scale. So I'd looked at some sporting opportunities, but never they'd really felt quite right. And then was fortunate to, just in the intro, before I went to the Bulldogs, I was CEO of Netball New Zealand, which was a perfect timing for me. I bought my commercial skills in how to drive and open doors in the sponsorship and commercial opportunity into netball that was launching the ANZ Championship. It was a joint partnership with Netball Australia, which is, in itself is a really interesting business challenge when you think about going to your biggest competitor and saying, let's get into bed together and actually create competition. So that's a, in itself, is an interesting dynamic about how you go about that, the mistrust that happens on both sides and how you have to build that trust to ensure that there's benefits for both sides in that opportunity. And, you know, we managed to take a sport and double, or if not triple, its commercial revenues because we brought a new competition to the market. We took amateur, the semi-professional athletes, and turned them into semi-professional and professional athletes. So the first time in Australasia that women could play in a professional, semi-professional competition that went for, you know, 16 weeks or, you know, sort of a half a year in training and everything, but, you know, sort of 12 to 16 weeks, and then allowed them to earn enough money to survive and be professional. And that had never happened in Australasia before. That was before the, you know, AFLWs and the Big Bash cricket and the like. So, you know, that was an incredibly, I'm incredibly proud of that and be part of a team that managed to pull that together and deliver it. You know, in a way that changed the landscape for professional athletes in a team environment was really special. But it was my commercial experience and the ability to like cutting a deal and knowing what a good sponsorship deal looked like because I'd sat on the other side as a customer was really helpful as we built that product.
Yeah, super valuable, I'd imagine. I mean, you know, the business context, it's clear, obviously, as you go through that, that there's just a lot of building blocks to address. And I guess that was a strategy. And by the way, apologies, Wikipedia, they did actually cover your Netball New Zealand. That was just it's a literacy issue of the host that I failed to mention that one as well, because I think that was, yeah, there was a lot to that, as you said. So I'm going to go up to the sort of top of my pyramid now from you know, that sport aspect, the business aspect, to I guess really what sort of, well, for you certainly brings those two together in a lot of senses and a lot of what I love talking about with people, and that's the cultural side of things. I think that's going to take us into some pretty interesting space, which I covered with Natalie as well, around leadership and diversity and so forth. But at a top level, you know, if you're in an elevator with somebody, I mean, I'm not sure how many floors you're going up. Let's say it's maybe 10 or 15. And you had to sort of paraphrase culture from whichever way you want to tackle it. What would you say to somebody in that elevator?
Yeah, it's about attitude and respect. You know, respect, trust and respect is sort of those two words that get bandied around all the time in relation to culture, but actually having them on your office wall or behind the receptionist desk and actually living them as an organisation every day is really different, and they present themselves in lots of different ways. And so until you've got an environment of trust and respect, and everyone's bringing their best attitude, their best selves to work every day, then I don't think you can really create a culture that's vibrant and supportive and has the capability to deliver effectively in whatever it is that you're looking to. And that trust and respect piece is hugely important. It has to be led by the leaders. They have to create that environment, you know, being authentic as a leader yourself and making sure that they can see the real you and that your values come through in the way that you lead and engage with the person that drives the forklift in the building, and a chance to go in and chat with them and say g'day and, you know as many names as you possibly can, and you know, hard and really big organisations, but being able to communicate at that level, but also stand obviously around a boardroom table and do the things that you need to do to represent your organisation and everyone in between, I think that's important. You know, I got some really good advice from my own mentor who said to me, you know, be yourself, be authentic, because it is one of your strengths, but don't get so close you can't kick their ass.
Yeah.
So I think that ability in leadership to see that, you know, people are authentic and real and approachable, and live the values of the organisation, but are prepared to make the hard decision when the hard decision is required. But that's done in a way of with respect for the people that might be impacted, or that the communication that you go about through that time is as authentic and as genuine and caring as possible, can actually see people and through a tough situation actually leave respecting the organisation because it was the way they were treated. So I think, you know, those bits are important. That trust and respect also allows you to have robust and respectful conversations. So I talk about respectful tension. That's what drives things forward. You can't all have a big love-in, because you all sort of, you know, it's a really good way to see everything, you know, start to slowly go backwards, because you haven't actually had the tough conversations and created the change in a modern world that we need to make. But at the same time, that's that tension needs to be respectful, because when it gets lopsided, that's when the culture starts to fall to bits. So, you know, that would be way more than 15 floors worth of
Well, you got stuck at 7. I mean, someone pushed the emergency stop. It's
fine. But in simple terms, I would say trust and respect. So these are not values, right? Because I think as values, they're not. But environmental things, trust and respect, and individuals bringing their best self and their attitude and open-mindedness to that every day are the three keys. How you go about building those things is more than 15 floors worth of explanation.
Yeah. Yeah, and hopefully I'm going to attempt to sort of unpack more of that with you as well outside of the elevator. But, you know, that trust and respect, as you said earlier, it's bandied around, but, you know, it's just trying to explain to people what it truly looks like, I think, is a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's putting your words into action, right? It is action, it's not words. And it's sort of really corny, and you get all these sort of like, you know, throwaway, you know, comments. But the reality is when you see it in action and you can see where it comes to life, it all sort of makes that real. And that for me has, you know, been one of those things that I've seen in leaders that I've worked with, and the example that they set. You know, my mentor, who used to be the CEO of of Kiwi Rail here, and when it was owned by Toll, and then, you know, once a year he would get in a train in Kaitaia, and he would go all the way to Bluff in the front with the train driver. And he said, I would learn more in those, you know, 2 days of experiencing, you know, hearing from the train driver, because on the ground, talking to the people, understanding what was happening. I saw what it stopped, what it looked like when we loaded things onto the train and off the train. Mm. When we, you know, those are the sort of opportunities that, you know, are important, I think, to connect to that level and really understand what's happening in your business at that level. And it, you know, I see Greg Foran, you know, serving the, you know, the drinks and the tea and coffee on Air New Zealand, and, you know, he's really understanding what the customer's experience is and what it looks like and how that, you know, is real. And, you know, when I first started at Netball New Zealand, I went on a tour and I, you know, I drove the minibus and literally got, you know, in and around the environment in a way that wasn't intrusive or didn't have any commentary. It just had the opportunity to observe and actually watch and see what the challenges were and see how the team engaged with the coaching staff and the strength and conditioning staff, and start to see what good looked like, and, you know, what so that you can start to taste and smell what not good might look like, and, you know, those things. So, you know, I think that ability to relate across the organization and feel comfortable moving into those different environments. And you know, you can always taste and smell when culture's going well, and you can certainly taste and smell it when it's not going well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad you mentioned Greg, because I was going to bring that up as well as an example to sort of get us into the leadership side, because there was a piece, I think, in LinkedIn, you know, and I've seen this pretty consistently, and that's the point I'm going to make to get your view on is, you know, the comment on this particular post was around, you know, is this just a stunt, or is the intent there to do just as you've described? And you know, as I recall, I think I've seen similar posts to that up to 2 years ago, you know, or probably not 2 years ago because we went quite out of COVID, but it's, you know, it seems to be a consistent approach. And also I have the benefit of some people who knew him in his previous role where his approach was exactly the same in respect to visiting stores to just get that on the ground stuff, and not just once for a, you know, for a photograph for the annual report, but just regularly and consistently. Is that to you sort of, you know, what have you seen and what are your feelings about that in terms of that sort of classic sort of photo opportunity versus doing things, you know, not necessarily a lot of things, but certainly the things you do well and consistently?
Yeah, and you know, it's sort of, you know, I've been lucky enough to hear Greg speak a couple of times, and, you know, he it's certainly not a one-off. He does that really consistently. I think equally before him, Rob Fyfe, you know, they had that accident off the coast of France, Perpignan, and he first thing he did was jump on a plane. We had, you know, the very tragic passing of Olivia Podmore in, suspected suicide. And we got the group together. It happened late on a Monday night. We got the, you know, key staff together. We had a conversation, and I said, I'm going to drive to Cambridge. The first thing I did in the morning was get up with our, you know, director of performance support, and we drove to Cambridge to be in the location where the grief was happening. Now, I didn't know at that stage whether the I was going to be of any value. I didn't know if I could do anything. I didn't know whether exactly what I was walking into. All I knew was that we were going to have a between cycling New Zealand staff, high performance sport New Zealand staff. We had a lot of really devastated people that didn't know exactly what the right things to do were in that moment. I got there. There was a war room set up. You know, Cycling New Zealand were working through all of the different things that they need to consider, how they were going to support the people they need support to. And it was, they were, you know, already doing some really good stuff. They greatly appreciated the fact that we'd come to be part of that. Our own staffs appreciated it. And, you know, I ended up doing a press conference that night, you know, which I wouldn't have been able to do if I hadn't been on the ground. And, you know, so you sort of got in front of the conversation. Whether that had ended up in a press conference or whether it had just been on the ground, people knew that you had shown their support. So sometimes that's instinct. That's not actually about it's definitely not about the photo opportunity. And if you do it for reasons, it's the wrong reasons. But actually that, you know, authentic, there was tons of tears, there was hugs, there was, you know, checking in on people, making sure that they were well, and, you know, we had a couple of staff that went a bit missing, and we'd made sure that we sent people out to look after them. So, you know, all of those things are the important part, and that's that trust and respect piece, which people only let you into those environments and feel safe with you there if you've built the trust and respect in advance. You can't just waltz in on day one and suddenly be there. Because they're like, well, who are you? Why are you here? Like, just because you've got the title of CEO doesn't mean that you can rock up and be part of something that's so intimate and stressful and emotional. So, you know, I often say that title should only give you the opportunity to prove your own trust and respect in your own style. Ultimately, it's what you do that gives you the respect with title.
And just being present, right? Just actually fronting up.
Yep, and fronting up to the hard things, right? It is, as you said before, it is easy to front up to the positive things and the good things, but it's when it gets really gnarly and difficult is the most important time to be seen. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's what leadership is. I think it presents itself in a lot of different ways, but it also comes with, you know, the pay packet, right? The expectation that as the person that gets paid at the level that you do have to deal with the good things, but you sure as hell have to deal with the tough things as well.
Yep, it's tough at the top. And I think the thing about the last few years, if I was reflecting on it the other day with some folks, is that, you know, if you're the CE or a senior executive, or even at a board level to a certain degree, your decision matrix, once you've actually leaned in and truly understood and, you know, been present and you know you have that trust and respect, that decision matrix, and again, I'm going back to Air New Zealand, I think is a classic example, is not one where you get anywhere close to the ideal, you know, result for all your stakeholders, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also not one size fits all. I think that's the other thing is the, you know, the experience to know when to lean in further, know when to step back, give people some space, you know, what know when you have to push other people to the front in a situation because their credibility in that particular environment is much greater than your own credibility.
Yeah,
you know, to deal with those situations, I think is hugely important. So, you know, there's lots of learnings around that you can see and pick up, you know, as I said, every single day around how you can see leaders doing this in their own way. And, you know, I'm watching all the time for those things that, you know, I can try and learn from and understand, you know, what good looks like.
Yeah, yeah. And that's changing, I guess, all the time as well, just depending on the context.
Well, it is. And, you know, there's no doubt there's the challenge. Well, some people would say it's not a challenge, but the world that we're facing in post-COVID where we've got a generation of younger people that think working from home is normal and that, you know, like, you know, you've got year one graduates turning up in an interview and asking, you know, how many days a week am I allowed to work from home?
Mm.
Now, I can't even imagine, like, when I first went for my first interview, like, you know, I couldn't imagine asking something like that. And, you know, that worries me, John. I think, you know, I really believe in face-to-face engagement and the conversations that you pick up by osmosis, the chance you can have a chat at the water cooler, the chance that you can, you know, overhear something and get involved in something from that's important to your role or your project or your team's project. And that's a really hard thing to do on Teams and Zoom when you've got you know, it's very linear and it's very much inside your own team environment. So that, you know, it really worries me about that silo effect that it can have on an organization. And, you know, there is some, you know, practical upsides. I know, you know, ANZ have decentralized their call centers. So for, you know, working mums and dads to be able to be at the call center and, you know, be able to sit and still do their job, but have more flexibility at home or the location they live, that's amazing. And I can totally see how that works. But when you're in an environment where, you know, value of face-to-face connection and contact and conversations that are multifaceted projects, there's no doubt that face-to-face is more effective in its outcomes. So trying to get that right balance where you've got a culture where people feel they can be trusted and have some more flexibility to not travel in high peak times or, you know, go to the gym earlier straight at 5 o'clock or 5:30 when they finish as opposed to having to travel home. All of those things are good, but I do worry about what the impact on the culture that we started this conversation about, what that impact will have.
Yeah, 100% agree. And I mean, you know, the ANZ example, I mean, you've got clear metrics there, haven't you? I mean, people are answering calls at home, but I think quite clearly, I don't think it's that contentious to say that a lot of people just see it as an easy ride. Increasingly, or if they don't see it that way, they're not self-aware enough to think about actually where their productivity and outcome level gets to by having, you know, that different environment. For some people it's great, I believe, you know, they can really focus. But I think what you're highlighting there is just that sort of contribution to team and contribution to outcomes. There's a lot missed without being face-to-face or close, you know, close vicinity to your project or your venture or, you know, your business colleagues.
And I had an interesting, I spoke at a conference last week, Bold Steps, which is organised by Dame Therese Walsh, and she put to the audience she told the story about how when she was a young developing accountant, she had a family drama happening. She had to bring her young child into the office to pick up some files. So she'd go to the hospital and look after her other child. And the partner said to her, you know, this is an office. This is not a crèche. What is your child doing here? And so, you know, that's not the reality of the world that we work in now. Workplaces are much more flexible about children being in there, or the flexibility to work from home. But she put to the audience that there is a risk that that this doesn't end up being the big regret of the progress that women have made around equity, that we don't choose remote working and isolation and missing those opportunities that you get. Because how do you get promoted? Well, you get promoted by doing a good job, and that's multifaceted, right? It's not just about the work that you do and deliver. It's how you engage in environments. It's how you present. It's how, what leadership opportunities do you step into? What does that look like? And if you're not getting those opportunities because you're at home choosing to be work flexibly and, you know, care for your children, which is obviously hugely important, you know, let's not make this a moment that we regret, because we have made some good strides in the equity space. But you'd hate to see that go backwards. And I think that is a conversation we have to keep live.
Yeah, and you've opened it up now, so I'm gonna just dive straight into that because you know, the women and specifically in leadership, you know, the things that got me completely off script with Natalie was, you know, in terms of her reading, you know, less than 8% women CEOs globally is a statistic. Whether it's the right one or not, it doesn't feel that far off, and the point is still, you know, horrendously clear. And I think for me, the challenges that, you know, if you look at consumer stuff from a marketing point of view, or anything that they throw out there in an academic context, or even your own direct experience, which you've had a lot of, I mean, these decision makers on, you know, large consumer purchases are predominantly women as well. And yet we have these business structures where there's just not a lot of diversity and presence around the table. Before we sort of get through that, I mean, looking at your career, I mean, first woman CEO of a National Rugby League team. So really keen to perhaps start into that conversation about your learnings or thoughts of that, even just getting appointed to that. I'm intrigued to whatever level you're comfortable sort of taking us through. And then if that wasn't enough, you know, probably the highest profile CEO role in Australian sport when it comes to Australia rugby and all the challenges and so forth that come with that. I mean, you know, now with that sort of women specifically in leadership lens, what are your thoughts as we sort of bake into some of the things that we just park for a moment through those experiences around where we're at and what we need to do?
Yeah, certainly the Bulldogs appointment was, you know, I was a dream come true. My dad had, you know, played rugby league for New Zealand. I'd grown up with him sitting on the couch watching Winfield Cup, which can't be underestimated in why I felt more comfortable stepping into the environment, because I had a, you know, 30-year underwrite into NRL, and actually understanding there wasn't a rugby league player in the last 25 years that had played in the NRL that I wouldn't have had some understanding, or at least knowledge or name recognition, or so I could walk in a room of great rugby league players and identify the ones that I could go up and introduce myself and know who they were, and, you know, had a good base understanding of the sport and the rules. And so you sort of can't get away from that. Like, it's like any job, right? You don't go in to be, you know, a CEO in the fashion industry if you've got no fashion experience. You can't go in and, you know, so it lent itself to that. They put me through an interview process which started with 4,000 applicants.
4,000?
And 4,000, crazy, eh? And ran it through to the end. And that was the greatest gift they could give me, because there could be no comment around tokenism, or, you know, just doing this for publicity or any of that. And, you know, that was the Bulldogs had some quite significant cultural issues. They'd had a significant rape scandal. They'd had a big salary cap scandal. And interestingly, when I first started, I'd go to a function in Sydney and, you know, people, I'd say, oh, I'm Raylan Castle, I'm the CEO of the Bulldogs. And they'd go, oh, yeah, you're from that rapist club.
Oh,
I'm like, wow, that's a really good. The good thing I can say after 4.5 years in that role, that wasn't what people said to me when they met me, and there was a much sort of wider and more family-oriented view of the Bulldogs and how they were represented and the work that we were doing in the community. We were the first ever NRL club to sign up with White Ribbon.
Yeah.
Which was why people said to me, you are mad, right? That is just going to blow up in your face because you're going to have a player on a domestic, you know, violence charge. And I said, yeah, you're right, we might. But the whole point of White Ribbon is how do we deal with it? How do we deal with it more effectively? How do we look after the family? How do we make sure that our players understand the impacts that that's going to have in the team environment? How are we going to understand organisationally how to deal with that and what to do with it? So, you know, some of those things were really, you know, significant. You know, as a CEO, when you get appointed by a board, that's a really pivotal moment because for a period of time you don't have to look behind you because you can look forward and concentrate on the business. But when the board changes and you have to spend time looking behind you as well as in front of you, that's when being a CEO gets really difficult because you should be united. The board and the CEO should be united and you should only have to work and walk into one direction. And you know, that's so that those first 18 months or so when you know you've got a united opportunity is where you really have to build the relationships and the credibility and the trust and respect that we talked about earlier into that environment so that when you do get some changes on the board, it might not be as straightforward that you've got some credibility to base the, you know, the direction that you're giving to the board and to the wider organisation. Yeah,
a couple of curiosity questions around that just for context. So the first one, you know, how many of those 4,000 applicants do you have a feel for or you may know were female?
I don't know. I asked the question, you know, when they first approached me about the job, I said, you know, are they serious? You know, would they seriously consider or is this just like a, you know, we had a woman in the process?
Yeah.
And I think the thing that's most disappointing is I'm still the only. So there has not been another female CEO, and there was one female CEO in the AFL for personal reasons and had to step down, and they've just appointed their second female CEO into the Kangaroos, and that's exciting. And so they now have a female CEO in the AFL, but there still isn't a female CEO in the NRL. And, you know, I don't want to be the only.
Yeah.
I didn't particularly want to be the first, but I just was. I wanted to be the first because that broke the glass ceiling so that other women can step into those opportunities. And that's
context,
probably
you went, you know, under your role in leadership as CEO, you won a national championship, right?
Oh, we got beaten. No, we lost in the final. So South beat us in 14.
Right.
That's the one piece, probably, John. If I was being really candid, that's the one thing that I am really disappointed about. I think to have left that and to have been, you know, the first CEO of a club that won a premiership would have been, would be extra special. But unfortunately, we couldn't get that one done. Grand final was as close as we got, which in itself was a truly unbelievably magnificent life experience that not many people get to experience. But I that's the disappointing thing is why has it not opened the opportunity for other women to step in and step up into that opportunity? Because equity and diversity around that table in the NRL leadership table is hugely important, and it's certainly not there in clubland at the moment.
So my second question to that then is when you were appointed and to today, if you know, I'm sure you do, how many of the board are female?
So at a NRL level, I'm not sure. The Bulldogs worked hard during my time to bring some female representation on the board, which happened.
Mm.
And I know they still have some female board directors, a female board director today. I wouldn't say that it's a it hasn't been as big a focus for the NRL, I think, as it should be. I mean, I think just, you know, 50% of your, give or take, between 35 and 45% of your customers of any NRL club are female, right?
Yeah.
So they have no female representation, to your point about buying decisions, represented on your board is
nuts.
It's nuts, right? It's totally nuts. Apart from the fact that it's also a really important way of taking and driving your decision-making and performance forward, because that's proven too, that the more diversity you've got on your board, the better outcomes for your organisation. And you've now got an NRLW, which is women's teams being represented by about 50% of the NRL clubs. And so you still haven't got representation by female on your board where you're making decisions. So it's illogical. It doesn't make sense.
No.
But sport is the last bastion of, I was actually saying last night, I couldn't find exactly the right words, but if you think about democracy in a way around the world at the moment, sport is actually the last bastion of power and control. So it's about federated models. It's about my turn. It's about making sure I keep the power and control for my little piece of the world. People represent, sit on boards wearing their hat for the town or the province or the team that they come from, as opposed to representing the organisation on which the board they're sitting on. So that makes leading in sport really challenging as well, because you can't make a decision as CEO and affect it and tomorrow. You have to take the organisation and the sport with you.
Yeah.
So it creates a lot greater and deeper leadership challenges than sitting at your table in a big New Zealand corporate and deciding to do a restructure and getting on with it. You've got to go through a lot of consultation and engagement to get to those types of outcomes.
I'll come back to the restructure piece, because I think that, frankly, is an easy out for a lot of people around, you know, tough conversations. But just rounding out this sort of section, you know, Australia rugby, obviously, you know, when you talk about diversity, you face some pretty interesting challenges there, you know, beyond the gender issue. Any learnings or thoughts before we go back into that, sort of how you actually structure and have these conversations to move forward on these things?
Yeah, I mean, well, I had a very public challenge around modern day diversity in the Israel Folau in the LGBTIQ community. On the one hand, it was really complex. There was lots of media interest. It was the fodder for brilliant media headlines and debate around the rights and wrongs of religion versus, communities having a right to have a voice and be included. On the outside, it seemed really complex. The reality is, on the inside, employment contract, employment issue, breach of employment contract, breach of the values of the organisation. And as a leader, you've got to step up and make those decisions. And they're not easy or straightforward, but they are the right ones, because I have a responsibility to provide a safe working environment, and I had a number of staff that didn't feel safe because they were from the LGBTIQ community. So, what my learning, John, I think, is that as we move into a world more and more where diversity is absolutely critical part of modern day leadership, we have diversity and inclusion policies, and we use those two words in the same sentence. The reality is that they're a bit like oil and water.
Yeah.
So it's really easy to have a diverse board, right? So you can write the names down and you can say, yep, this looks really good. And particularly in the context that we face here in New Zealand of our bicultural journey, which is something I'm enormously proud of and think New Zealand will lead the world in.
Mm.
But how you give everyone safe space to be able to be open and honest in that environment, and when you've got genuinely diverse opinions coming from opposite sides of the table, that's an incredible leadership skill to be able to bring that together in a cohesive way where your organisation can continue to perform. And, you know, that's where it's easy. Like I said, there's a policy that goes diversity and inclusion. Everyone's like, job done, you know, wipe your hands, right, that got that policy. The practical implementation of that is much more challenging. And that certainly was my outtake of my experience there. And I wouldn't change that experience for the world, because it certainly taught me a lot. And, you know, I've always been someone who feels you know, personally very passionate about the underdog and making sure that everyone's got a voice. And, you know, that was certainly an opportunity to step up and represent a community that hadn't had a voice publicly or hadn't always had a voice publicly.
And I think what you highlight there is, you know, these systemic issues that often precede you as a CEO, right, around, you know, the contracts and the terms that are written and the policies and the way and the culture actually that, you know, is kind of you can change it and you can start transforming it, but you are faced with, you know, what has been sort of set out in the past, which, you know, back to a lot of the narration you've given so far, you know, what I'm picking up is really, which I totally agree with, is that it's all about getting the building blocks in place to actually, you know, build a house that stands up strong. And if you've got some, you know, some legal or systemic elements of that which just slow you down or actually take you down, you know, different paths, it's incredibly challenging, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I also think you've got to decide what leader you want to be. And sometimes actually being the leader that stands up to a really tough issue it also means you might not be the leader that can see that issue through to the end or continue doing what you were doing before. So sometimes the person that has to make the really tough decisions and create a change in environment, a change in structure, or you know, actually turn an organisation upside down to evolve and change a culture and move some people on, might not be the right person to lead that through. And sometimes I see leaders compromise their decision or decision-making because they want to continue to be the CEO. And I suppose I've always, you know, been preferred to take the passage of making the right decision for the organisation in the moment and the decision that you had to make for the future of the organisation, recognising that you might not be there to take it forward. And, I mean, you know, my examples were Israa Folau and a free-to-air broadcast deal for Rugby Australia. That was distinctly unpopular.
Yeah.
Whilst it was the right decision when your biggest competitors all got free to air, but it made some people in long-standing relationships feel very uncomfortable. And ultimately, they decided that I had, having opened the door and created an opportunity for that to happen, I wasn't the right person to continue it on, you know, going forward. And, you know, is that hard in the moment? Sure. But do I put my head on the pillow and go, I think we made the right decision for the organisation with the challenges it was facing? Yeah, I think we do. So I can put my head on the pillow and sleep well, because I think we did the right thing for the organisation to grow and move forward.
Yeah, and I think to your point earlier, you know, and also to the points of this core sort of, you know, what does trust and respect look like? It's an incredibly high bar lifted if suddenly you have to be looking back and forward at the same time, isn't it? Quite stressful.
Yeah, it can be, and that's where having your, you know, your there's a number of different ways to describe it, but your go-to people, the people that you can trust to have those conversations with, you know, the people that you know will call you out, and you can you know, be honest in that feedback and take that feedback because you know it's coming from the right place. It's why you can't run your business through the feedback from social media, because that is, you know, irrational and all over the place. But it does. I mean, people said to me when I first became a CEO, it will get lonely, and I probably didn't really quite understood what that meant. And and whilst I don't think I've ever been lonely, haven't been lonely because I've been lucky to have some really great people around me that I trusted to be able to go and have a safe conversation with to make sure that I was, you know, heading in the right direction. And if I wasn't, then I could change tack slightly because they gave me some really good, you know, advice or feedback, or I could go and have a glass of wine with people that don't care what I do for a living and don't care what is facing me every day. They just know me, you know, from the girl that went to school that used to have a perm way back in the 80s, right? And they, you know, so they don't care. So, you know, find your thing and work out how you get out of that, you know, white hot heat of leading, you know, make sure that you have the self-awareness to go and do it and take yourself out of those situations so that when you come back in, you can be focused and you can be come in with the right attitude and enthusiasm to do the hard, you know, mahi, or the, you know, make the tough decisions you need to make.
There's probably a book title in that, you know, from the girl with the perm to the, you know, a boss leader in the sports industry.
Don't go Googling because you might just find a photo.
Oh, there we go. All right, there's an action item for all of us straight after this. I mean, we've got about 10 minutes with you, and thank you so much for your time. So close to the end of the year. That won't mean much to our listeners because I don't know when they'll listen to it, if they listen to it at all. I just wanted to tackle two things that I think sort of underpin this, you know, the challenges, the learnings, all of these things. And I think it's this is something that Natalie touched on in terms of there's a thirst and a dearth of good material, regardless of whether you come at it from a woman in leadership point of view or just leadership in general. But, you know, the basis for having these courageous conversations and these frank conversations, you know, I mentioned restructure before because my opinion is that for a lot of leaders, a lot of boards, even a restructure is a very convenient way of you know, supposedly reducing risk by not having to have tough conversations for people who just, you know, bottom line is are not performing. What's your playbook there? What are your thoughts around, you know, the basis for an individual conversation? And then, you know, probably the context there is like you hear a lot of CEOs saying, you know, there's a lot on at the moment. And my view is, to your point earlier, CEOs, you know, are paid a lot of money and they have that respect and mana in play because they have to make the calls and come with, you know, there are probably an extra sentence to that, which is, you know, there's a lot on at the moment, but we've chosen to prioritize this. And then to your point, and that means that, you know, we haven't focused on this, and that might be because we don't have the skills or the capability we think's right there, and that might involve some people being replaced. But if I boil that right back down to the basics again, you know, what are those sort of platform elements for you of having these you know, frank conversations?
Yeah, I mean, it's not comfortable for anyone, right? So no one, and no matter how many of them you have, they're always tough, right? So you always get that sort of butterfly feeling in your tummy when you've got to have a difficult conversation with someone. So let's get that on the table first. I think the important thing is that you have to be sure of your legal position and make sure that you really understand the issue that you're dealing with, but then you park that and put that in the back drawer, right? So that's your back pocket, so you know what that looks like. Yep. And you put the person in front of you in the front of that conversation because they're a human, they've got some they've got to feed their family or pay their bills or their mortgage or whatever it is, and so you know that the conversations are going to be difficult. And the third thing is they will not hear anything past "we need to make your position redundant" or "we have a concern about your performance" or you know, because once they hear that, anything you say to them after that, they will not hear. And so when you sort of start with those three things, that's a pretty good place, I think, to start having the conversation. When you have some EQ and empathy, it tends to help the conversation and I think ends up with a better outcome where you might need to have a person leave the organisation, but they'll still leave it feeling trusted and respected, rather. Yeah. And I think that's important. There is no doubt our labour laws at the moment are very challenging and certainly sit in the deeply in the employee space. Now, there's many situations where that's absolutely right, but I do think it can make some of these conversations more challenging. So, you know, in a more pragmatic way, having a commercial approach to a conversation. This is not working for both of us. Here's a respectful exit package that enables you to continue to do the things that you need to do, but allows us to move on as well as a good way to go. Now, not everyone's got a bottom line that allows them to do that, and not everyone, when you work for government like I am at the moment, that's necessarily a great way to go about it. But I do think there's a balance in there because the death by 1,000 cuts is not fun for anyone.
I mean, there's never a perfect process, is there? But the one challenge I do see with that approach, which I very much align to, is, you know, this issue I think we have, which I think is impeding a lot of our work around trying to advance, you know, more capable leadership of any sort, is that those sorts of agreements tend to put people out into their next job opportunity with a little bit of a misconception about, you know, the role they performed and how well they performed it. And it just fascinates and frightens me to see, you know, all sorts of people turning up in similar roles where clearly it just hasn't been a strength of theirs for several roles, if you look back historically. But that sort of gets a little bit murky when you take that sort of trust and respect approach.
Yeah, and I think there's always ways to word, you know, performance reviews or ref checks and things like that, which can be sort of people can read between the lines. But I don't think we do each other any favours by exiting people from our business to say we're pleased to be rid of them, but good luck to the next business that comes along. I'm not sure that's really particularly in senior roles, a little bit different in middle management, where people can learn and grow, you know, and change because of the experience that they've had. But I think, I'm not sure that, to your point, restructuring, you know, is the way to go about it, because I do think those, you know, as I talked about at the top, you've got to show leadership sometimes. That comes with having difficult conversations and removing non-performing people from the business, and you have to do that in a way that's respectful to them but is also the right thing for the business.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about respect, I mean, obviously there's different time continuums, right? And I think a lot of people actually evolve and grow to the point where they flip and feel, you know, some degree of disrespect where there weren't frank conversations about what skills and capability they had been able to bring to a role, and they didn't, you know, in hindsight, and now they feel like I didn't have the opportunity to work on those things to become better at them. I just, you know, kind of there was an easy path to solving the problem primarily for the organisation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's where professional development is a really important part of what the support that we should be giving to our employees. And, you know, for, you know, certainly many sporting organisations whose resources are very thin, that's not the reality of the world that they live in. But in bigger organisations that are really well funded and well supported and have, you know, great people and culture teams, it has to be an important part of the support that we give. You know, many people are under huge pressure at the moment post-COVID, and, you know, mortgage rates going up and, you know, pressure with families, and, you know, having a more holistic approach to looking after your staff and a more welfare, wellbeing approach, certainly in the long run, will be more beneficial for your culture. But, you know, ultimately, if you're good non-form, you've got to deal with them.
Yeah, dead right. We've got about 4 minutes, and folks, I'm to blame for this, because my technical team had some horrible issues at the beginning of this, which they took some time to deal with. But we're back on track now. The one thing I haven't covered that I wanted to chat with you, and I'd love to have you back later down the track if I do actually keep doing this, which I'm enjoying actually. I don't know how many people are listening, but it's quite fun. You know, is this imposter syndrome element? Now, you talked about professional development. If there's one thing that I, you know, I'm hearing more and more that really isn't well served from any current sort of courses or academia and so forth, is just, you know, just how to address what seems to be an increasingly common challenge that people have, and that's the way it's sort of been rolled up as imposter syndrome. What are your thoughts?
I think we have to change the name.
Yeah.
We have to change the name to, particularly to my female colleagues, to normal nerves.
Normal nerves.
I've started it. I'm not sure if it's going to fly. But I think as our females have to start thinking about their feeling of imposter syndrome as normal nerves. When you go into any new job, when you step into an employment process, when you turn up on your first day, whether you're the accounts clerk or whether you're the CEO, it's hard, right? It's everyone's looking at you and you're going, I'm not sure where to go and how to use the toilet, and I mean, use the toilet as in find the toilet.
I'd probably have challenges with that. Using the toilet.
Make a cup of coffee. But until our female next level of female leaders and female executives actually put themselves forward for opportunities with the confidence that they can do the job equally as well as their male colleagues, be it in a different way with a different approach. And yes, there'll be a bunch of things that you don't know how to do, and yes, there'll be things that you'll need to ask people for help with. That's normal. There's nothing abnormal about that. That's totally the way the world works, and have the confidence to step in and be really good at the things that you're good at and know that you're going to have to ask for help on the things that you're not so good at is part of the conversation. And being nervous about how that feels and not lacking confidence in certain areas is something that we have to have an open conversation about, because if we can proliferate this conversation about imposter syndrome, the female, we will continue to struggle with gender diversity. That is just the reality of, because you can create the opportunities, but if the female executives aren't prepared to walk through them because they've got imposter syndrome, that's not very helpful. So I've started the conversation Normal Nerves. Not sure if it'll get traction, but I really think it's a conversation that we need to have.
Normal Nerves, I'm going to say it from now on. So they've got another supporter there. I think it makes total sense, and it brings some balance to, you know, the discussion as well, and takes it away from an immediate assumption that it's just one sector of humanity's challenge. I love it. We're out of time. Really appreciate you taking the time again at a very busy time of year. It's been a fantastic conversation, and I'd love to already invite you back at some stage, perhaps to actually lead out with Normal Nerves and just some more thoughts around, you know, the support and the thinking as you evolve that. I think it's a fantastic way to sort of drive some change, which, yeah, imposter syndrome, I think, is well and truly done its chips as a general sort of collection of a number of challenges that we have. So thank you, Raylene Castle. I really value your friendship and really appreciate you taking the time to do this. You are, of course, also an advisor to All Things Considered, my new venture with Andrea Vandermeer, and I really appreciate that. And the last word is yours in terms of what the good folks out there might sort of hear from you as a final statement as they wait for my appalling end music of the podcast. But actually, a little tip for you, don't actually have to listen to that. You just press the pause or stop, or just, you know, kind of hit the cross and it's not there. But last word is yours.
Oh, thanks, John. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it and really enjoyed the kōrero. So that's great. I don't know. Don't believe everything you've read in the media about if you Google Raylene Castle. No, seriously, I think, I've been really fortunate across my career to work with some unbelievably great people. That's where I've done all my learning. And there's different ways of approaching things, and it doesn't always have to be by how the book says it, or, it's called experience for a reason, and you can see and learn from those people around you on any given day. That's certainly been my learning journey, and been lucky to filled with some great people and some great colleagues that I've turned into friends, and for that I'm really appreciative.
Raylene Castle, kia ora, wahine toa, nā mihi nui, and muri kiri himiti. Thank you so much.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.